I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. 13 dead bald eagles were found on the Eastern Shore last weekend. Wildlife advocates are offering a $25,000 reward for information. Yet there is no shortage of bald eagles in this region. Our national bird was once endangered, but now the Chesapeake Bay hosts more bald eagles than there have been since colonial times. Today we talk with eagle expert Brian Watts and legendary Virginia conservationist Mitchell Byrd. Next week, the two will fly out over the lower Chesapeake Bay in a small prop plane with a former fighter pilot who calls himself Captain Fuzzo at the helm. It's the three-man team's 25th year scouting for nests together. The bald eagle, its resurgence, and the pressures on it now on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks so much for tuning in. The discovery of the carcasses of 13 bald eagles on a farm near the Delaware border of Maryland's Eastern Shore last weekend has captured the thoughts of people all over the country. It was the biggest single die-off of bald eagles in Maryland in the last 30 years. Day by day this week, conservation advocates around the country have added to a fund to solve the mystery. Now the reward money for information leading to an arrest and conviction in this case has reached $25,000, and inspectors are going door to door searching for clues. A spokesman for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service told me this morning that it could be days, it could be weeks before the Federal Animal Forensic Laboratory in Oregon, where the carcasses were taken, knows exactly what killed the bald eagles. State officials are quoted on a working theory that the birds were poisoned, perhaps feeding on the carcass of an animal that had been poisoned. There were no signs of external trauma to the birds. It is a very sad story, but the bigger picture for bald eagles in the region is much brighter. DDT and other insecticides nearly wiped out bald eagles in the 1950s and 60s, but since controls were put in place, the iconic bird has revived in a big way. Bald eagles were taken off the endangered species list in 2007, and they've multiplied beyond anyone's predictions. The Chesapeake Bay hasn't seen this many bald eagles since the colonial period. What have we learned about our national bird since DDT was banned in 1972? What can we learn from their stunning recovery? And just how do you count a bird that nests 75 feet up in a tree? Two biologists who have spent decades tracking the Chesapeake Bay's bald eagle population join us today from the studios of WHRO in Williamsburg, Virginia. Brian Watts is director of the Center for Conservation Biology, a joint program of the College of William and Mary and Virginia Commonwealth University. Brian Watts, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
I'm so glad you could join us. Professor Watts and our other guest, Mitchell Byrd, co-founded the Center for Conservation Biology. Mitchell Byrd, that's B-Y-R-D, is a retired biologist and a conservation legend in Virginia. When he first started conducting his annual eagle census on the lower Chesapeake 40 years ago, there were scarcely any bald eagles in the bay. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And let me start with that. I just asserted, but let me ask you, what was the situation, the population of bald eagles in the Chesapeake region when you started your survey four decades ago?
In 1977, when we started the surveys, we had probably 32 or 33 nesting pairs in Virginia and possibly about the same number in Maryland. The whole population in Chesapeake Bay was somewhere in the mid-60s in numbers, and they were not reproducing very well at that time.
And is that why you started the survey?
The survey was started as part of a general Commonwealth of Virginia program monitoring and following species that were on the endangered species list at that time.
How many bald eagles are in the Chesapeake region now?
Well, we hope to find that out over the next 2 weeks.
I realize.
I would suspect that we'll find maybe 2,000 pair. But in Virginia, it's more likely 1,000 pairs. We will not be doing anything but Virginia.
Right. And I want to talk more about the survey in a minute, but I want to ask Brian Watts. DDT nearly wiped out the bald eagle population, but DDT had damaging effects on lots of wildlife. What role did the bald eagle play in getting DDT banned?
Yeah, I think the great thing about bald eagles is it's a great umbrella species. It's a species that all of us as Americans really recognize and appreciate. And so I think politically it probably had a large role in banning DDT and like compounds in the early 1970s. And those decisions at that time were really instrumental in the recovery, not just of bald eagles, but other species that we recognize here in the Bay, osprey, great blue herons. There are several species that are at the top of the food chain that really recovered after those decisions in the late 60s and early 1970s.
What were the other big factors in explaining the resurgence of the population of bald eagles?
Yeah, I mean, when we go back in time, there were a whole parade of insults that affected bald eagles back in time, all the way back to colonial period. The real decline began sometime in the mid-1800s when firearms became widely available. Much of the population here in the Bay and elsewhere throughout the continent didn't really have a favorable view of eagles. Watermen here in the Bay didn't like them because they took their fish. Duck hunters didn't like them because they stole their ducks.
Let me interrupt you because you know the behaviors of bald eagles and I don't. When you say that they took the fish, they would they would swoop down and take fish that they saw near the surface of the water, or did they actually sort of somehow steal the fish that the colonists were fishing?
Yeah, both of those. I think there was the impression that they were reducing the fish that the watermen here in the Bay depended on, but also they would take fish from nets. Fur trappers didn't like them because they took their muskrats and beavers from traps. And so there was a long period there where eagles were shot on sight. Farmers would shoot them in the nest. And so that continued really up until the 1940s and 1950s there. In the late 1800s and early 1900s, there was a market for eagles. People collected eagles and eggs. Even during the Great Depression, an eagle egg would bring $15. And so there were
collectors. That was for that was something to be eaten? An eagle egg?
No, something to be sold, sort of like a stamp collector.
Oh. Okay, I interrupted you. You were saying there was this market.
There was a market. There were people that had certain areas that they collected. Edward Court up around the D.C. area had a large number of nests that he monitored and took eggs from. Harold Bailey down here in the lower Chesapeake. And so all of these things sort of contributed to the decline. But really, when you come up to the post-World War II era is when we have the deepest chapter of the decline, and that was related to the contaminants problem. Once we get to the early 1960s, there was almost no chicks being produced, and so adults were dying, but they weren't being replaced.
And explain to me what impact the contaminants, especially DDT, specifically how it affected the bald eagle.
Yeah, it caused some direct mortality of free-flying birds like adults. We had a case down here on the James where a bird was picked up in 1963 in convulsions and was later determined to have died directly from DDT. But primarily, it influenced the viability of eggs. And so birds were laying thin-shelled eggs or non-viable eggs, and so they just weren't producing enough chicks to replace mortality.
And scientists understood that. That was part of the argument for banning the pesticide?
It was suspected. There were some cases with other predator birds throughout the world that gave credibility to that, but it was contentious at the time, still is for some people today. Some people today still don't believe that DDT was a major factor in some of the declines. So there certainly was controversy at the time, but it was the right decision that was made.
That is eagle expert Brian Watts here on WIPR on Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. His colleague, Mitchell Bird, a conservation icon, is also with us. They're joining us from the studios of WHRO at the College of William & Mary. And we're talking about the bald eagle and what it has survived and what it is facing these days. You can certainly be part of this conversation. Our toll-free number is 1-866-661-9309. If you're calling from outside the Baltimore area. Our local number is 410-662-8780, 662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Help me make sense of something, Brian Watts. You were saying that the colonists, the farmers and the fishermen, didn't think much of the bald eagle. How did it get to be the national bird then?
There were certainly varying opinions as to what should be the national bird. Ultimately, eagles won out, but it took a number of different meetings of the Continental Congress to pass eagles as our national symbol, so it certainly wasn't without controversy at the time.
Do you think it's that status plays a role in its resurgence?
Yeah, I really do. I think that we as Americans identify with bald eagles as our symbol. It's one of the best known species globally, and so I think it does have some weight. And the truth is that when you look back over the recovery and you think about what contributed to that, it was really the decisions in the late 1960s and early 1970s that contributed to that. One of the most gratifying things about the recovery is that we did that, not we, the small we as the conservation community, but the large we of the American people. It's something we all can be proud of. It was decisions that we made that changed the trajectory of an entire species.
Mitchell Bird, you have been working for lots of animals, but the bald eagle in particular. When you started the survey, did you foresee that there would be the kind of revival that we've seen?
I don't think I felt that the revival would be like that. I don't think anyone did. I think the change in the population has been astounding to most of us. Obviously, we would have expected some sort of recovery, but nothing like the numbers that we're presently seeing.
Brian Watts, I interrupted you in kind of an historical sweep you were giving us of the pressures on the bald eagle, especially in this region. We got to the point of DDT and some of the other DDT being banned and controls being put on other pesticides. Was the revival immediate, and did that sort of take away the big threats against the bald eagle?
It's pretty amazing the response to removal of DDT. The eagles were declining at a rate of about 10% per year. After the banning of DDT, if we look to the late 1970s when Mitchell started his part of the survey, the population really recovered and has been growing at a rate of 8% per year since that time, and it's continuing to do so. So we've come out of that low point and continued to recover since then. And that is due to a couple of things. One is a recovery in the productivity that the eagles have had and a decrease in mortality. And the other factor that's contributed is our specific protection of the habitat, and that is continuing to today. Even though eagles were delisted in 2007, as you may know, they have their own federal law, the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act, and so habitat for them is still protected.
Let me get straight on a couple of things. You said delisted as no longer defined as an endangered species.
That's right.
In 2007.
Yes, they were removed from the list of threatened and endangered species, which is a federal list.
But there are other laws that still give them special protection.
That's right. So since they were listed federally in 1968, they have been protected by the Endangered Species Act. After they were removed from the list of protected species, the lead legislation for their protection reverts back to the 1940 law, which is a federal law called the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act.
And what does it, what kind of protection, can you give us a brief idea of what kind of protection that gives the bird?
Yeah, the protections are virtually identical to what was mandated under the Endangered Species Act. You can't kill birds, you can't take birds, their nests are protected, and to some extent you can't disturb the birds around the nest sites or in their feeding and sheltering areas. And so I think a lot of people don't realize that even though they have been removed from the Endangered Species Act protections, the protections, the federal protections, really haven't changed that much.
Hmm. We have to take a short break here. I've got lots more questions, and some of our listeners do too. When we come back, we're going to hear more from wildlife biologists Brian Watts and Mitchell Bird. They've been studying the Chesapeake Bay's bald eagle population for decades. Do you have a question about bald eagles, about what kind of dangers they've survived and what kind of dangers still face them? Give us a call. Our local number is 410-662-8780. Our email address is midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Mitchell Bird. At 87 years old, he will board a tiny prop plane next week for his 40th flight census of nesting eagles in the lower Chesapeake Bay. Also with us is his one-time protege, Brian Watts, now director of the Center for Conservation Biology in Virginia, which the two of them founded. This will be his 25th year conducting the flight census. Do you have questions about eagle behavior? Join our conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Brian Watts, we were talking before the break with and left with a very upbeat picture of the resurgence of bald eagles in the Chesapeake Bay. But there has been an enormous amount of development around the Chesapeake Bay over those same decades since the 70s. What has that meant for the bald eagle?
Yes, that's right. So we are losing about 7 square kilometers of space around the Chesapeake Bay watershed annually, and that is effectively eating up bald eagle habitat. And so when we transition out of sort of the DDT era, we entered in the early 1980s in an era where the greatest threat was really habitat loss due to residential development. And Mitchell and I have been lucky enough to fly the Potomac for many years, and what we've seen is that a lot of the resources are flowing out of DDC and Baltimore right down the Potomac and consuming habitat. And so it's one of the largest concerns that we have.
How does that play out? Mitchell Bird, I mean, tell us what happens when bald eagles lose habitat.
Well, I think they have a couple of options. They can either emigrate, which I suggest is happening because we're having birds appearing in the Piedmont and the mountains of Virginia. Or they have the option, of course, of moving into suboptimal habitats. We have a number of birds that are actually in urban environments. I would suggest that this is not the best habitat, but in many cases it may be virtually the only habitat to have available easily.
Well, I mean, are the eagles, the ones whose nests you count, are they fighting with each other over territory?
Oh, very definitely. And there's a great deal of evidence that non-breeding birds are interfering to some extent with the breeding birds, which are actually nesting.
Explain to me non-breeding birds versus breeding birds. I mean, I presume that they're biologically the same. I mean, why are some birds breeding and some not?
Well, bald eagles take essentially 5 years to reach reproductive maturity, and so that would constitute a breeding bird. Therefore, we have a number of birds in the population that are lower than 5 years of age. But on the other hand, we also have a lot of adults which are competing for nest sites, and many of these are designated as non-breeding birds simply because they're not finding a suitable nest site. These are the birds that are interfering, we think, with some of the nesting activities of the actual breeding birds.
Brian Watts, tell me what makes a nest site.
Yeah, most of the nest sites that we have here in the Chesapeake Bay are within a kilometer of large bodies of water. So eagles are a group, are part of a group of eagles worldwide. Bald eagles are, and virtually all of them depend on water, and most of them are fish eaters. And so proximity to water is a requirement for them. The other thing is that they require large trees. Eagles have broods that are 2 to 3. Each of those birds are going to have wingspans in the 6-foot range or larger, so they need a large platform to raise their brood. Most of their nests are 6 to 8 feet across at the surface. And so
wow.
In order to support a nest of that size, they really need a large tree. And so most of the nests that we have are in large specimen trees, which are limiting in the Chesapeake Bay.
So, I mean, when we talk about habitat being lost to development, are we talking as much about the square footage of land, or are we talking about trees being felled? I mean, is it really the trees that are the limiting factor?
Yeah, when we talk about loss of eagle breeding habitat to development, it's really displacement. It's that eagles historically have been disturbed by people. They've been hunted by people. And so it's really the presence of humans oftentimes more than the loss of forest. What we're seeing in recent decades, though, is signs that eagles may ultimately habituate and be able to nest in neighborhoods with us. That is one compromise or solution to the habitat loss. If they can habituate and eventually nest in these urban areas with us, then the habitat loss isn't such a major factor.
I'm trying to picture this. You're describing an eagle with a huge wingspan, I think you said six foot,
mm-hmm.
That might nest in the oak tree next to my garage?
Right, and we have quite a few examples of that. In fact, on the Rappahannock, we had a nest over a lady's house, and it would frequently drop fish on her roof or on her porch. So we do have examples of that. They're still fairly rare compared to the rest of the pairs, but we've certainly seen it. Up on the Potomac, we had a nest right next to a couple's pool in their backyard. So yes, they are increasingly nesting in urban areas, but from our surveys, the urbanized ones represent still only about 3 to 5% of the overall population.
This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm talking with Brian Watts and Mitchell Bird, two eagle experts based in Virginia with deep roots in the Chesapeake Bay region. They're joining us from the studios of WHRO at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg. Listeners, do you think bald eagles should still be protected by special federal legislation now that they're doing so well? You can join our conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780, or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Mitchell Bird, I want to pick up on something you mentioned a few minutes ago, which is that your survey is concentrated in the lower Chesapeake, in the Virginia area. Why no survey in Maryland?
Well, that would be a responsibility of the state of Maryland. And I think several years ago, Maryland made the decision, the people in Maryland made the decision that the population had recovered rather substantially. And given, you know, the available fiscal resources to do these surveys, decided to concentrate their efforts elsewhere. Virginia, in effect, did the same thing. The state of Virginia, which was supporting surveys in the earlier days, decided to reach the point that this was no longer necessary. Brian and I felt this was a very, very long database, and it should be continued. Once a species is delisted, you don't drop it. You continue to monitor it to see what eventually happens with it after delisting. And so we've developed the resources, not easily, to continue the surveys in Virginia. And so that's why we do it in Virginia, and it's not done in Maryland.
And tell me how you do this survey. I know you do it by plane, but it's, I mean, and you've described these nests as pretty large, but still, how do you go about counting eagles from an airplane?
Well, we've developed a search pattern. We have a pretty good idea of where our nests are going to be located. And so we follow a search pattern. We follow all the tributaries in Tidewater, Virginia, all the way up to their very upper extremities. And we usually fly it somewhere on around 300 to 400 feet in altitude. And so we're not a great deal of height above the trees in which nests are located. Once we fly over urban areas, we're required to increase our altitude. But in the other areas, we're usually flying 300-400 feet. And so we're very close to these nests, in effect.
And Brian Weiss, who is doing what during the flight?
Yeah, our pilot, Captain Fuzzo, he is flying and maneuvering the plane. So we fly as slow as we can, and we systematically follow the tributaries, searching for new nests, and we're checking old nests. I'm typically looking for new nests, and as we check nests, Mitchell is recording the data that we see. So we're actually looking not just for nests, but the condition of the nest, whether birds are incubating. That's the reason why we typically don't start the survey until late February, early March. Most of our birds are on eggs by that time. And so we want to document breeding attempts. We actually come back in late April and we'll refly the nests for the year, and we'll actually drop down on the nests and count the chicks in the nest from the plane.
I should have asked. I don't have a sense of what the migration patterns of bald eagles are. Are these are birds who are wintering here in the Chesapeake region and spending summers further north?
Yeah, one of the interesting things about the Chesapeake Bay population is that our birds are resident year-round.
Oh.
But as you mentioned, the Chesapeake Bay is a convergence area for other populations in late spring and early summer. We get birds that migrate up to the bay from Florida and South Carolina. Those birds are finished with their breeding, and then they migrate up to spend the summer with us. They go back to breed in the early fall. In the late fall, we have birds that migrate down from New England and the Canadian Maritimes, and they spend the winter with us. They follow waterfowl down here. And so we have this convergence of all these eagle populations from the entire Atlantic seaboard right here on the Chesapeake Bay. And so over the course of a year, we might have 30,000 different individual eagles that use the bay.
And you talked about new nests and old nests. I mean, if a bird migrates away, is that nest up for grabs in this competition you've described to us for nesting places?
Yeah, so eagles are territorial, and the adult pair of that territory will defend its nests. That really intensifies in the October period as we run up to the breeding season. But yes, the truth is that one of the reasons that we continue to survey here is because we're interested in what happens with the population when they transition from growing to saturation. What happens when we reach a limit?
What?
And we are reaching that now.
A limit of the number of bald eagles that can be supported in this region?
Yes, that's right. And so what happens is that the birds continue to produce young, and those young continue to mature. But once they reach breeding age, they don't have anywhere. And so it sets up a conflict between the haves and the have-nots. And so what's happening is the floaters, or these birds that don't have territories established, begin to fight with the territory holders. And so we're in a period now in the Chesapeake Bay where we have this tremendous conflict between the haves and the have-nots. And so we're getting more and more birds killed through fights, and more birds brought to rehab centers.
So, I mean, they actually fight it out. And what does an eagle fight look like?
Yeah, you can imagine with the talons and everything that these can be bloody fights to the death. And I had a student 2 years ago, Courtney Turin, who looked at intrusion rates, and because we're interested in the behavioral feedback that happens when a population reaches capacity. And so what happens is you get a lot of intrusions. And when we reach capacity, one of the interesting things that happens is that the breeders may only be 15% of the population. The birds that don't have territories that are of breeding age represent maybe 50% of the population. So there's three times more birds that are of breeding age but don't have territories, and so those birds are putting a tremendous amount of pressure on the territory holders. They are sitting around the territories year-round looking for opportunities. They're trying to disrupt breeding. We've had some cases of cannibalism where they come into the nest and eat the small chicks, trying to disrupt breeding. And so that turmoil is one of the things we're interested in understanding.
I can imagine. It's Brian Watts here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass, Brian Watts, and Mitchell Bird, his colleague, are two eagle experts based in Virginia. You can be part of this conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Tom has called us. I'm not sure from where. Tom, welcome to Midday.
Sheila, it's Tom from Glen Burnie.
Glen Burnie.
I live on the Knapp's Creek.
Welcome.
And so I might personally experience this.
And your comment, Tom?
Sheila, I work with builders and developers, and I help them build energy efficiency into their homes and developments. And these gentlemen said that the boundary for eagle nesting is roughly a kilometer. What I see in new communities today is that 1 kilometer zone is being acquired by very wealthy people, homeowners, and they're building large lot single families in most cases. What encouragement can the environmentalists provide to developers who really have a customer who wants to live in the Chesapeake region to change zoning behavior, not to take away homes, but to cluster so that the tree, the old-growth population, isn't clear-cut, and provide nesting so that humans can live near the eagles that we want?
Interesting question, Tom. Let me see whether either of our guests has an idea about that. Tom is basically asking how we could arrange development to be better neighbors so that bald eagles would be encouraged to live among us. What do either of you think about that?
Tom brings up a couple of important issues there that we have grappled with for the past couple of decades and continue to. One is that it happens, as you might expect, that the eagle habitat that we're concerned about is some of the most valuable property throughout the Chesapeake Bay region. So, and it's in very much demand by the human population. And so we have this sort of old-fashioned land grab going on between eagles and humans. And that's why we are so interested in some of the birds that are beginning to nest in urban areas. You know, maybe habituation to human disturbance may help the future of eagles to live with us. In terms of the development issues and recommendations to landowners, yes, it's true that one of the best things that landowners can do that own land that they want to develop along the shoreline is to have some set-aside forest available for wildlife. That includes eagles, but other wildlife would benefit as well. And so, yes, he was suggesting some clustering zoning. We would be all for that. Whether that can pass the local jurisdictions has been difficult historically, but it would certainly be a recommendation that would help eagles in the long term.
We need to take another quick break here. When we come back, we'll hear more from eagle experts and longtime colleagues Mitchell Bird and Brian Watts. Benjamin Franklin wanted our national bird to be the turkey. Where do you think bald eagles would be if he'd gotten his way? And what do you think about the idea of bald eagles as neighbors? Do you think that would work well? Join our conversation by sending an email to midday@wypr.org or calling us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about bald eagles. We're talking with Brian Watts, director of the Center for Conservation Biology, a joint program of the College of William and Mary and Virginia Commonwealth University. He co-founded the center with our other guest, Mitchell Bird. Though retired, Bird continues to take part in the annual nest surveys of bald eagles in the lower Chesapeake Bay. This year will be his 40th and Watts' 25th surveys. Do you have questions about this longtime collaboration? Join our conversation. Send an email to midday@wypr.org or phone us 410-662-8780. 410-662-8780. Several of our listeners are interested in the news of the day, the 13 dead bald eagles that were found. Elizabeth called, couldn't stay on the line, but she wanted to know whether it's likely to have been rat poison. I don't know whether either of you have any theories about the bald eagles who were found dead. Is there anything you want to say about it?
Well, several years ago, we had a similar event to this in Virginia. And in that case, it turned out to be secondary poisoning. It was due to a pesticide called carbofuran, utilized in the planting of corn crops. And what was happening was the farmers were spilling a little bit of it at the end of the rows when they would drill in their corn. And we had a number of eagle mortalities from that. It was not a direct poisoning of eagles. It was a secondary thing. And until we get information back from Oregon on the toxicology results from this, from these birds, it'd be difficult to speculate on it, but I would suggest it's quite possible there's some form of secondary poisoning. Hmm. If that's the case, then the procedure would be to try to track down the origin of that and identify what the compound was.
Priscilla is calling us from Annapolis. Priscilla, welcome to Midday.
Hello. I wanted to relate a story about a posting that I did on Facebook of about 50 eagles located off the South River near Riva Road in Annapolis. There was a dead deer in the water, kind of a swampy wetlands area, and these bald eagles were waiting their turn to get a bite of this deer. It was the most phenomenal thing I've ever seen, but I've got about 25 pictures of these eagles very politely waiting in the trees and waiting on the ice on the water to get a bite of this lovely, delicious deer.
Priscilla, thank you. Thank you for that image. Let me ask our eagle experts whether this makes sense to you, that after our conversation about how eagles can fight each other for a nesting place, the idea of them waiting politely for a piece of meat doesn't quite fit my image. Would this be expected behavior?
Well, I'm not sure how politely they were waiting, but it is quite true that eagles are opportunistic feeders. They'll feed on almost anything they have access to. We see them feeding on carrion all the time. Perhaps this is why Benjamin Franklin called it a bird of ill repute.
Priscilla, thank you for the call. Let's go to Patty in Baltimore. Patty, welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm calling also from Northeast Baltimore with a Facebook story. Just this week, somebody in the community on the community thread posted a question, did I really see a bald eagle flying above our neighborhood? And everyone chimed in that within the last 2 years, maybe 5 years, we've seen an amazing increase of bald eagles in Baltimore City, fishing at Lake Montebello, the reservoir, and hovering above the Parkville Shopping Center. And I think it was just a really magical thread. People were so excited and so pleased that there was a resurgence in eagles when we all, the baby boomers among us, thought that they would be extinct by the time we came of age.
Patty, thank you for telling us about it. Brian Watts, do you find that the fact of the resurgence of bald eagles is still news to a lot of people?
Yeah, we sure do. And, you know, it's gratifying to see the public recognize that we have eagles around now. And it is great that they're able to see them on a more regular basis. The truth is that just about anywhere in the watershed, if you keep your eyes to the sky, you will see eagles just about everywhere now. And really, I'd, you know, like to reemphasize that that is really the product or the fruit of the decisions that were made by Americans in the late 1960s and early 1970s. We should all be proud of the recovery because there were key decisions that were made there by us as a society that showed that we do value our national symbol and that we cared that they were declining.
And I presume that those key decisions tended to benefit other species also.
Yes, for sure. Eagles sort of led the way. When you look back through time, it's been one of the greatest conservation success stories in our nation's history.
Roberta sent us an email. There is a camera on an eagle's nest at the Blackwater Wildlife Refuge. This year, the parent eagles abandoned the nest after the eggs were laid, so there will be no new eagles from that nest this year. What causes the parents to abandon a nest? Can either of you address that?
There can be several factors that lead to abandonment. In urban areas, disturbance can be one, and that's why we're concerned about disturbance. On some years, if we have really heavy rainstorms and the adults have a difficult time keeping the eggs dry, that can lead to abandonment. But as the eagle population is churned, and that particular pair there at Blackwater a couple of years ago, I know, had a disturbance event from an intruder. Again, this is the downward pressure from all of these floating birds out there. That increasingly is causing the breakup of breeding attempts, and that may have been what happened here.
That's Brian Watts, director of the Center for Conservation Biology in Virginia. Our other guest is his longtime colleague, Mitchell Bird. They co-founded the Center for Conservation Biology. You're listening to them on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast, and you can call us. You can be part of this conversation if you call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Mary in Cockeysville, we may have answered part of Mary's question. I'm not sure. Mary, welcome to Midday.
Yes. I was last year at my niece's in Cadoris Park. She lives outside, and they had put the rangers had put a cam there. It was so successful. Everybody in that area was just, I mean, we saw the chicks being born. We saw the mother, you know, being over the nest in February, I guess it was, and she was just surrounded with snow, and you could see her head pop up. And then we saw the most wonderful things that she would bring to them to eat. A skunk.
It sounds like you got very, very hooked on this on this unfolding drama.
She's calling me and saying, "Oh, you should see it today. You know, there's part of a deer up there." Oh my gosh! So it was just, it was wonderful. And they even, you know, we saw them fly away and everything. So it was. I don't know if there are any more like that, but that was on a YouTube that you could see. And it was Cadoris Park last year at this time. So I just wondered, is that the usual breeding time? I mean, the, you know, nesting time?
Let's ask. Thanks for the call, Mary. February is a typical nesting time?
The breeding season really typically starts in October when they start nest maintenance, and we begin to see courtship flights and that type of activity in the December, January period. Some of our earliest pairs in the Bay are down here to the south, and they may lay around Christmas or earlier, but most of the population in the Bay lays in the February, early March period. And so most of our birds should be on eggs or nearly on eggs right now.
Thank you for the call, Mary. John is calling us from Aberdeen, and I think, Brian, you know John. John, welcome to Midday.
Hi, Brian. Hello from APG.
Hey, John.
I just wanted to address the question you had earlier in the show about, do we still need to have protection for the eagles now that they've recovered? And one of the aspects that you get when you protect the eagles and protect their habitat is you protect all the other animals that live in that circle. You know, so it's a great benefit to the biotic community as a whole. And, you know, so therefore I think, although not necessarily intended, you know, the rest of the community benefits from the, you know, everybody's willingness to protect the, you know, the national symbol. So that...
John, thank you. Thank you for that comment. Mitchell, what has the growth of the eagle population meant for research?
Well, I think in terms of our own activities monitoring the eagles, this has led to a lot of spinoff to other aspects of eagle biology. Brian's mentioned some of them, like the intraspecific competition. One of the studies that was done, in fact, in conjunction with Aberdeen, I think, using a lot of transmitters on birds, have delineated some communal roosting areas that we were unfamiliar with. These are very important areas. They often have a long history of stability. These are areas in which large groups of eagles roost together. We had a number of them before that we knew of. That particular study led to the identification of quite a few others. So I think one of the things that's come out of all of these surveys has been this directional movement into another number of other areas of eagle biology.
Robert is calling us from Pikesville. Can we talk to Robert? Okay. Robert?
Yes.
Welcome to Midday.
Thank you.
Your question? Your comment?
My question is, are American Indians allowed to use golden eagle or bald eagle feathers in their ceremonials? And if so, how do they obtain them? And the second question is, if someone is in possession of golden eagle feathers, dating back, in my case, 50 or 60 years, am I allowed to sell them, to use them, to display them? I would like to hear comments from your experts.
Thank you for the questions, Robert. Can either of you address those?
Well, I think the Native Americans are allowed to have bald and golden eagle feathers under permit. I think that may be the only group that has that particular privilege. But they're not allowed to get them by going out and collecting birds to get them. They're either from molted feathers or birds that are obtained from otherwise deceased, feathers that are obtained from otherwise deceased birds. As far as the question of his feathers he's had for 50 years, I'm not sure what the answer to that would be. Maybe Brian could comment on that.
Any thoughts, Brian? We have just a minute left.
Yeah, in terms of the sale, there's no allowable sale. And in terms of some grandfather clause, I don't believe so without an appropriate museum permit.
Thank you for that call. And I want to thank both of you. This has been a very interesting hour. I think we've all learned a lot about our national bird that we didn't know. Brian Watts and Mitchell Bird, co-founders of the Center for Conservation Biology, with Brian Watts now directs. It's a joint program of the College of William and Mary and Virginia Commonwealth University. Mitchell Bird has been doing these surveys of the nests in the Chesapeake, the lower Chesapeake, for four decades, Brian for 25 years. We wish you luck on the one that you're about to embark on. And thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. And want to thank also Raymond Jones, the engineer at station WHRO, for engineering this conversation. And I want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. And I want to thank you for listening and participating. Tune in Monday. We're going to talk about Baltimore's detention center. Does the city need a new jail or not? I'm Sheila Cast. Hope you have a great weekend. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.